This is the Tara Lake Podcast. I'm Tara Lake.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, tonight is your answer. It's the answer spoken by young and old, rich and poor, Democrat and Republican, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, gay, straight, disabled, and not disabled. Americans who sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of individuals or a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America. It's been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
On November 4th, 2008, Barack Obama was elected the 44th President of the United States of America. In a country where federally sanctioned racist discrimination ended only 44 years ago, the election of a black president is a veritable quantum leap, literally miraculous. But that's just part of what makes this event remarkable. The election of Barack Obama represents a historic mobilization of political will in our country, a shifting dynamic in generational leadership, the political coming of age of America's youth, a new level of racial and cultural maturity in the country, and a hopeful transition in world leadership. In a celebration that reverberated across the globe, thousands of people literally danced in the streets from Harlem to Hong Kong, Compton to Kenya, Indianapolis to India. In this special two-part debut of the Tara Lake Podcast, I invited friends to join me for my own official digital Barack Obama block party. There's still some grape soda and barbecue out back. Why don't you join us?
Waiting for this moment. Spend a long time praying. Praying for this moment. We hope for this moment. And now that we own it, for life I'ma hold it. And I won't let it go. It's our fathers, our brothers, our friends who fought for freedom, our sisters, our mothers who died for us to be in this moment.
M.K. Asante Jr. was headed out to a screening of his new documentary, The Black Candle, a Kwanzaa celebration, when I called. The Baltimore-based filmmaker and writer is a professor of creative writing and film at Morgan State University. His most recent book, It's Bigger Than Hip Hop, came out in September 2008. He reflected on the hip-hop movement, the post-hip-hop generation, and the election of Barack Obama. Hi, M.K.
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome to the Barack Obama block party.
Oh, I'm glad to be at the Barack Obama block party. This is a great time to be at a block party. I'm glad you're doing this.
Thank you so much for participating. I'm wondering, man, you're up there in the Baltimore area, D.C. area.
That's right.
We've just learned, of course, about Barack Obama's win. He is now President-elect Barack Obama. What is
right.
it like in Baltimore right now?
The energy here in Baltimore is deep. You know, it's profound. There's a profound sense of victory. I mean, you didn't even have to be watching TV in my neighborhood. All you had to do was just listen. I mean, you could just hear the chants and people celebrating, and I was among them. So there's a tremendous amount of energy. I teach at Morgan State University. One of my students today said, you know, I've never seen anything like this. He said, brothers who be hustling on the corner, they was in line, you know, waiting in line for an hour to vote. She was just quite amazed by that. And I think we all are very happy, a lot of energy. It's frenetic over here. It's Philly and New York all over. So the energy is really beautiful.
It's beautiful that you brought out the young folks and your students. It makes me think about your exciting new book project. Tell us a little bit about it. I got to tell you now, the first time I heard the title of your book, the Dead Press song just started rocking in my head.
That's right. That's
I said, wow, it's bigger than hip-hop. You better go ahead.
Yep, I always hear that beat when I say that, you know.
Yeah.
that hip-hop be. But yeah, it's bigger than hip-hop. It's a new book. It's nonfiction. It's creative nonfiction. So it's really from a different cloth than a lot of the traditional academic books about hip-hop culture, about young people of color. But it's a book that uses hip-hop as a springboard to look at a lot of urgent social political issues that affect young people all over the country, all over the world. Frantz Fanon, the great Martinican philosopher, activist, and revolutionary, said that each generation, out of relative obscurity, must discover their mission and either fulfill or betray it. So this book is about the fulfillment of this generation's mission, and it involves a lot of issues that young people have been organizing around and really demonstrating their power. And I think Tuesday was really a profound example of that power.
You know, I really wanted to talk to you a bit more about that. Young people were so energized by this campaign, especially because of all of the energy that the Obama campaign put into sort of mobilizing young people, including young people, right, in ways that just hadn't been done before by any other candidate. You saw the youth activism. He was actively reaching out to young people and college students to be his community organizers, yep, of sorts, precinct organizers, and his workers on the streets. He was literally building street teams, which is, right, to me, so hip-hop. That face-to-face, right?
Yeah. And really, it's hip-hop. And like hip-hop, it's in the long tradition of Black grassroots activism, because you can go back to each generation and see those kind of efforts taking place. You know, I just finished this film, The Black Candle, yes, story of Kwanzaa. And the brothers and the sisters who were around in the 60s were telling me about when Kwanzaa first started, how they were going door to door with these, you know, with pamphlets and really doing, they had street teams basically to promote it, and mm-hmm, they didn't want the mainstream media to know about it. So this is, you know, this is something that's just, I think, a part of our culture. And we see it in hip hop. We see it now. We see it. We'll continue to see it. I think, you know, it's always more effective, you know, when you're talking about movements, you have to reach people. And I think that's what they were able to do. And I think that's what we've been doing in our community.
And what is this going to mean, do you think, to this young generation? You know, I was reading a description about your book. I loved what it had to say about really chronicling the rise of this generation that sees beyond, and I'm quoting here, the smoke and mirrors of corporate manufactured hip hop, and is building a movement that will not only change the face of pop culture, but the world. What then does this mean? You know, this is a generation of young people who have been empowered in new ways. What is this going to mean for them moving forward, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's profound. In terms of hip-hop, I think there's something really profound. In a lot of ways, the authentic, true message of what hip-hop was created for, November 12, 1974, by Afrika Bambaataa and the Zulu Nation, was really, you know, set in motion and re-embodied on November 4th. You know, there's this great quote in Battle of Algiers where they say, to fight a revolution is hard. To win a revolution is even harder. But the real work begins once we've won. I think many people are taking that call seriously now.
I want to come back to your film, The Black Candle, looking, yes, at the meaning and history of Kwanzaa. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the film and also what this means for African people as a whole in the United States.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. What I did with The Black Candle, which is narrated by Maya Angelou, that's a film that uses Kwanzaa as a vehicle to celebrate the African-American experience. The Black Candle, you know, I think in this period of time, in this moment, is really timely. That's what everybody's been saying. We've been showing this around the world. We just showed it in London to 1,000 people. People have been really responsive and receptive. And it features the founder of Kwanzaa, other people like Chuck D and Dead Prez, Amiri Baraka, Sonny Patterson. Really going to have a lot of meaning, not just for Kwanzaa, but all year round, because I think that's the ultimate message of the film, that, you know, you want to be united and self-determined and working with each other and doing business with each other and having a purpose and being creative and having faith. You want to do all those things 365, you know what I mean? So the film's message is about really embodying those principles and using Kwanzaa as really a lifestyle, you know?
Wow, man, I so appreciate you stopping by the Barack Obama Block Party.
Hey, I'm here. You know, just tell me where the barbecue is at. You know what I mean?
Morgan State University professor M.K. Asante Jr. joined us from Baltimore, Maryland. Even the block know we need Barack. Put my liquor down, even through the weed in my sock. If the land could be reached through speech, then the man giving the speech on the lead all the people.
lost hope. Now I'm giving hope. A president my color, that'll be living hope. Living hope. No shame, bro. No game, bro. Vote for Barack Obama.
I am a poll monitor, and I'm mainly just out here to watch and make sure everything goes smoothly and there's no irregularities or anything. I have numbers where I can call and get people assistance. The program is called Strive. It's with a group called Southern Regional Economic Justice Network. This is a pretty historical time. I mean, we're probably looking at history in the making, and I'm pretty kind of excited.
Max Davis is one of several people I caught up with on a very cold and rainy election night 2008 on the campus of North Carolina Central University in Durham. Unfortunately, I couldn't talk face-to-face with many of my friends around the world, but some of them were nice enough to drop me a postcard on the meaning of Barack Obama's win.
Okay, my name is Kai, and I'm dropping an audio postcard to the Barack Obama Block Party from Kingston, Jamaica. Barack Obama being up for president this year was a very important point for a lot of Jamaicans. I have a lot of family members who are born and raised Jamaican but have become American citizens. Still live here but made a point this year to vote absentee, though they usually don't get involved in the politics of the states. A lot of people were just excited to know that the effect that this might have globally, the effect it might have on our country and being able to have better relations. I was at my brother's house watching with my family. My dad has been following the election pretty much as if he were an American citizen. There is a lot of excitement. As much as people were confused and bewildered when President Bush was elected 4 years ago, 8 years ago, they are as excited that now there's someone else who is coming into power in the United States and can represent hope and change, not just for the United States alone, but for people living in other countries.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed the trail toward freedom.
Harlem-based creative photographer and visual journalist Carusha Muse may have actually put the camera down when I called for her insights on documenting the historical election cycle. But I doubt it. Recently featured in the Lincoln Center exhibit titled Underexposed, Black Female Photographers in America, Carusha produces multimedia projects for LowHUD.com of the Journal News, serving New York's Lower Hudson Valley. Carusha!
Hello, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us at the Barack Obama Block Party.
I appreciate being invited.
Okay, can I call you Rue for the interview?
Yes, you can call me Rue.
Rue, a photojournalist. Your photography has taken you around the world. I wanted to ask you about some of the work that you've been doing in your capacity as photojournalist at the Journal Hudson News. I want to take you right away to this project on 71-year young Joan Horton.
One of her dreams was that one day she would be able to walk into that polling booth and pull that red handle.
Through it all, we will be saying, thank you, God. Thank you, Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you, all the soldiers that went before us.
Just looking at her story, her journey to the polls as a voter and as a campaign volunteer, and the story of her father-in-law, could you tell me a little bit about documenting that experience?
It was a whirlwind. I always knew that I wanted to do something about this election. I knew it was historic. I didn't know Barack was going to win or McCain, but this is a story of my ancestors and a story that I remember hearing as a child. It had to be told. At first, I was just going to document Harlem. And then my bosses came to me. They're like, Rue, we think Barack's going to win. We need to know what this means to the black community. And I was thinking in my head, it means a lot. Like, the fact that there 40 years, and now we have a viable candidate. So I went out searching us, and then I met Miss Horton. She's a small, quiet, reserved woman, but she reminds you of your auntie, your grandma. No, for real. Let me tell you how the day started off.
Okay.
I wasn't expecting the lines to be as long as they were.
Wow.
I was in line for like 3.5 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
So I called Miss Horton, and I'm like, yeah, can I roll by your house a little bit later? She's like, sure, baby. I ain't even got out the bed yet. So when I finally get to her house, her father-in-law, Mr. Horton, who's 98 years old, he is dressed to a T. You think he is about to preach in the church on Sunday. He has his good suit on, and I love the fact that he just topped it off with his Hawaii hat.
Oh,
he had no nail yet at all of Barack Obama, just a simple Hawaii hat. And he sang "This Little Light of Mine" in two steps all the way down to the car, and then when he got out the car, he two-stepped to sign his name and in the poll. And I just thought, he's 98. He has seen some things in his life. And then just the fact that she wanted to get her father-in-law to vote, she was gathering folks up in the neighborhood, like her neighbor. He's 44 years old. He went into prison at the age of 18. He just got out like a year ago.
Hmm.
And this is his first time ever voting in his life. And it was just the dynamics of not only her civic duty to vote, but to get other people around her and to get other people to understand the importance of voting. And it's not the only thing that you do. You also have to be an active member in your community.
Mm.
Because voting one time is not the only way that you can revive your neighborhood, bring jobs in, and bring about change.
Right.
And that's what I loved about her, because she was a community activist who also believed in voting. And I think that's what's most touching.
Such a momentous occasion. We see the meaning of this moment for various generations, and also too a symbolic passing of the torch from one generation to the next generation. I heard someone say that young people are coming of age this election, that the hip-hop generation has certainly come of age. But you did a wonderful project dealing with folks even younger than that, young folks who were voting, preparing to vote for the very first time. How many students were there that you looked at?
We did 100 kids. And we asked them, what's on your mind? And just asked them questions about voting. And I think what was most surprising about doing this project is how informed these kids were and the issues that matter to them. We tend to write them off, oh, they're young, but they're passionate about what they're passionate about. They understand the world we have given them. They want it to be different. They want there to be a change. I think that was what was so exciting about listening to these 100 young people.
Now, I don't know if folks can hear, but I hear you coughing just a little bit. I hear a little tickle in your throat.
Yes, I'm good now.
And I understand that you may have picked up said cold partying out on the streets of Harlem, USA, or I should say documenting the partying on the night of Barack Obama's win. Could you paint a picture for us?
I'm going to have to set something up. I live in Harlem, 10 blocks up from 125th. I read that they were going to have a big jumbotron. That's what I really wanted to do, and be there from the start, from like 7 o'clock, and just document it. But I was working on this project. They announced that Barack was the 44th president at 11. I'm still interviewing. And so I get in like around 12:30, 12:45. It's kind of quiet, starting to rain, and I'm thinking, black folks ain't really out. Before I even got to 130th Street, I just heard noise. I got to 125th Street. Sounds of euphoria and joy and horns honking, people backflipping in the street. This one woman was just two-stepping by herself, like no one's around her. She's in her heels, just Jesus, Obama, and two-stepping. And this is the first time ever in my 30 years of living have I seen a black man run up and down the street with not a little bitty speck. I'm talking like I'm on stage at a Buju Banton Jamaican concert waving the flag. Come on, some I'm an American.
Oh.
I am an American. And then back to him, a brother just comes up and hugs me. He's like, I'm happy. I'm happy to be a black man. And it's just one person at the next just loves. And what I love about Harlem is this. Everyone was together. Yeah, white folks, Brazilians, Colombians, Ecuadorians, Senegalese, doing their own version. But my favorite was at like 2 o'clock in the morning, they had the Barack Obama cultural dance-off.
Wow.
You had brothers from North Harlem doing the Obama shuffle. And then you had the Brazilians doing the samba slash capoeira Brazilian dance. And then you had people from Ecuador bringing out their traditional instruments. And everyone was paying homage to this man. This must have been when it was like the end of apartheid, when the Berlin Wall fell down. because people were so joyous.
Carusha L. Muse, thank you so much for dropping by the block party.
And anytime.
Listeners will be able to see links to all of your projects. And I look forward to reviewing the Harlem Project again. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Carusha L. Muse is a photographer and visual journalist based in Harlem, New York.
Oh, gon' crush the groove. It's the old bummer shuffle gon' groove. Throw your hands high, put them in the sky. Kick your legs out and then you start to slide. Time for a change, so we switching it up. O's in the air, so we giving it up. Gonna get loose, about to tear up the flow. It's a brand new dance, I know you want some more. Slide to the east, put your O's in the air. Slide to the west, shake a derriere. Jump to the front of you, the Democrat. Jump to the back and work it out like that. Rock with it, gon' get down low. Rock with it.
I voted early because of the situations that you have when you come at the last minute. The last day as far as like address changes or not being registered, things like that. This is my first year.
How old are you?
20.
Okay. What does this mean to you as the first opportunity to vote in the presidential election?
A whole lot, especially with Obama running for president.
Why was Obama's candidacy important? Why did you choose him?
Because he's going to make a change.
I feel like this year, 2008, is like this history making. And just to say I was a part of this, you know what I mean? Obama is history. Yeah, first time voting, and I think I'll be voting from now on. I mean, every vote counts, because what I do now affects my future.
Also, on election night, 2008, that was 20-year-old John Gray, a North Carolina Central University student, and Arlandia Parker, 22. Both were first-time voters.
You seem to float onto the floor. Democratic Convention 2004. I never wanted anybody more than I want you. So I put down my carry sign. Knew I had to make you mine. Smile black and sexy, you're so fine. Cause I got a crush on Obama.
I caught up with actress and comedian DeHaley Hall somewhere between Shenanigans and Los Angeles. Her short film, Mandingo in a Box, is currently airing on HBO Networks. Last season, DeHaley was a featured player on Fox's Mad TV. Her web sketches appear on Tickles.tv and other outlets. We chatted about spoof comedy, sketch performance, and the recent election cycle. DeHaley Hall! How are you?
It's LA.
I have to officially welcome you to the Barack Obama block party.
It is an honor to be here and a pleasure.
You know, one of the things that really stood out during this election cycle was comedy. And, you know, what kind of role did spoof and sketch play and comedy play during the time that we were getting to know the candidates?
Spoofs and sketches were absolutely instrumental. This election cycle had so much drama. There was all this energy and angst, and we needed an outlet. I mean, this election was rife with so many of, like, the theatrical tropes, the underdog, the villain. It was great.
I wonder, was it the presence of the issue of race for a lot of people or the issue of gender for a lot of people? What was it about the array of candidates this year that led to such an outpouring? Because it seemed like there was so much more work being done.
Absolutely. I mean, we had the woman with Hillary Clinton, the old guy with McCain, the black guy with Obama. And then just when we thought, when because Hillary was gone again, she was defeated by Barack Obama. I like saying that. Is that wrong? We had another woman again. So
okay.
We got back to those dynamics again. For Hillary Clinton's campaign, it really was about gender.
Mm.
She made no bones about it. It was something that she screamed from the rafters. But for America, you can't talk about race in that way. Which I think was very interesting. I mean, black people understood that, but I don't think the general population understood how race was very touchy, but ageism, like in McCain's case, and gender could be fun and be open. Even victimization, you could throw that up in the air.
Mm.
But black people
throw that out.
Yeah, that kind of double standard. But you brought up the notion of this woman and how there was another opportunity for that. What was the impact of the Tina Fey phenomenon?
Wow. I mean, Sarah Palin was a game changer for Tina Fey. I've been a fan of Tina Fey forever. I mean, I like that she's a writer and a performer, and then now is able to do her own thing, like have her own show and be a force. But despite all these Emmy wins, like she was winning Emmys last year, despite all these Emmy wins and critical acclaim and all of this to-do about being even the first head writer, female head writer on SNL, nobody really had her in the radar. And Sarah Palin changed all that. And it actually was a game changer for SNL, who for like most of the election had been completely trounced by like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Now they were back with a sense of relevance. But Sarah Palin, just in her nomination, it was comedy. Just the fact that she was picked was sheer unadulterated comedy. And I felt unadulterated pandering, too.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I guess that kind of pandering to the American people really declared open season. I'm not sure if McCain and his camp recognized that all bets were off, in a sense. Okay, and I'm going to shift a little bit. One of the reasons that I really admire you is that you found a great way to remain so prolific as an artist, that is, as a person who has found mobility in mainstream work as an actress and a comedian, a person who has found mobility in your independent work. Recently, you did a stint with Mad TV during this election cycle, but then also to see you participating in this sort of wonderful comedic dialogue that's happening in outlets like YouTube. Could you tell us a little bit about your stint with Mad TV? For me, as soon as I think of that, I think about the Oprah piece.
Well, first off, thanks for saying that. It makes me feel like I'm a lot more active than I think I am. As for Mad TV, that was amazing. I got to play Oprah Winfrey, my hero icon, a woman that I love and hate, envy and admire. She's just so complex to me in my life. Like, I think she's phenomenal. But I got to play her rapping with Obama, and it was really cool. I mean, I got to, one, rap, two, play Oprah, three, be with the man of the year, Obama, all in one sketch.
Now, I would not be standing here if it were not for the efforts of one woman. And no, I am absolutely not speaking about my wife.
She took control. I think you know. Talking about,
who wants an election? Look under your seats.
Girlfriend, Barack's not smoking crack. The future's bright and also black.
Like this Burberry scarf.
She's got the book club and that magazine she wrote. She just really want to read how to think and how to vote.
I felt like I got a chance to like get the torch passed to me because I really loved the work that Deborah Wilson had done on Mad TV as Oprah. She made her that iconic person, and now I get a chance to do that.
This is a historic moment, absolutely. Barack Obama is now President-elect Barack Obama. What are we going to see with comic treatment of the Obama family or Barack Obama?
I don't know what we're going to see comedically. The great thing about it is we're going to have to think about a lot of stuff that we didn't want to talk about. Race being one of them, it's going to be fun and exciting to actually see black love in your face. Dinner time! They catch these photographs of Barack looking at Michelle. And I'm like, do they know that they're men? People are watching them. You know what I'm saying? Like, he gives her these looks like, I'm going to tear you up. And she gives him these looks like, I love you, boy. You better do it. You know what I mean? Like, it is palpable. It is fierce. It is wonderful. And also, having him also kind of, like, changes, like, the tropes of the black man. All these kinds of things are completely now flipped on their ear. But I think, you know, what's more funny for me, it's, like, these, like, tiny little things that he says or that they do, like the fist bump, that become major ripples and like reflect something that is way deeper beneath the surface that people don't want to admit. So I think that's where the humor is, not necessarily with them, because they're not looking at the camera, they're not saying gosh and darn, they don't say things like that one, but just their very presence has created such a cosmic shift in the mental perceptions of the world. That is where the comedy is rife.
Actress and comedian DeHaley Hall is based in Los Angeles, California.
I got this. First black press. Now ain't that nice? I'm in the highest office, that's right. Now I can do whatever I like. Now I can do whatever I like. So what? I'm half black and half white. So what? I fist bump with my wife. Man, I can do whatever I like. Man, I can do whatever I like. Palin was the hottest mess that ran for office. She spoke so odd, I could have swore it was a comic skit. She got people excited, but still she couldn't.
Hi, this is Dorothy Burwell. I'm dropping an audio postcard to the Barack Obama Block Party from London, England. When I heard that Barack Obama had won the election, I had been home for probably about an hour after having gone club hopping with a bunch of friends, both expats and local Brits who are all supporters of Barack Obama. My phone rang at 4 a.m. as soon as the California polls came in, and I was overjoyed. I screamed, I shouted, I immediately ran upstairs to wake up my flatmate to tell her that Barack had won the election. And then once everything hit me, I cried. I called my closest friend in North Carolina, and two of us cried while she ran through the streets celebrating herself. And honestly, it was one of the happiest times and one of the happiest moments of my short life. I hadn't met a person in London who was not jubilant about the prospect or the actual event of Barack Obama winning the election. I saw so many people who were members of the British community who were rooting for Barack Obama, and after the win, that they, you know, wanted to stop and have conversations with every American that they come in contact with just to talk about how much difference it's going to make in America's standing within the world, how much hope they bring to so many people of all different walks of life.
Also, they got mad when he bought in Harpo. No, I mean Oprah, get that hope up. Put them all in line and sign them folks up. Show them that McCain ain't the only soldier. Show us what black love is. Yeah. Show us how you love that woman and you hug them kids. Show us how to fight Barack. Come on. Cause right now, guns and crack cocaine is all we got. Teach us about Wall Street falling stocks. Dow Jones, how homes get crushed on blocks. They try to spy on you, go in the trash, pry on you. Man. Call you a terrorist and lie on you. And talk about problems with your past. To have you exiled in Alaska, we not having it. Imagine it, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, the real Mavericks. He had the audacity to hope. All we gotta have is the capacity to vote.
Kai Wright pulled over to the side of the road on the outskirts of Lake County, Indiana, to discuss the role of independent media in the recent election in California's Proposition 8. The Brooklyn-based writer and editor is a regular contributor to TheRoot.com and countless other publications. His latest book, Drifting Toward Love, Black, Brown, Gay, and Coming of Age on the Streets of New York, dropped in January 2008. Kai Wright.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you so much for stopping by the Barack Obama Block Party.
It is my pleasure.
You threw yourself so much into this issue, so I just want to get right to it. It was really exciting to read what you had to say about so many of the issues connected to the election and voter protection this year. I'm wondering if you could talk to us about what you thought the role independent media and the blogosphere had in this election.
Well, I mean, I think particularly with voter protection, that's where we first saw real serious attention to it in the media. By the end of the election cycle, thankfully, there was a lot of aggressive coverage at all levels of media about the sort of battle at the polling place. But that was, I think, a result of so many people, not just journalists, but activists and bloggers and advocates being out there saying, hey, This is going to be important this year. But I think that the really aggressive coverage in the independent media early on in the election cycle made it so that by the time we got to Election Day, it was no longer a fringe issue. And a perfect example is the Michigan Messenger.
Yeah.
And the story that they broke around the Michigan Republican Party's efforts to come up with a list of votes that could be caged, which is, you know, these mass challenges based on foreclosure rules.
Yes.
And that would have sounded like a crazy thing if it had come up at the end of the election cycle. But they covered it early on. They broke that story. And lo and behold, we saw it happening in Ohio, in Colorado, and all over the country. And we owe that to the real strong journalism there. In the face of legal challenges from Michigan GOP, they didn't back down. Independent media did a really great service, along with a whole lot of other folks.
You know, you spent a great deal of time sort of documenting this moment in political history, serving as a watchdog reporter for sources like The Root and The Washington Post. You damn near called the election in October with that piece, Measure the Drapes. You talked about the battle of the ballot and some of these voting challenges. What would you say were some of the most critical issues of this election for Black voters and for the larger electorate? And what would you say were some of the most prominent outcomes, aspects of this wave of reform that you talked about?
Right. Well, two things. One, I mean, I do think, to pick up on the first question, is this the establishment of the attack on voting rights as a legitimate and important and meaningful issue in the course of this campaign season is super important. We have watched over the last 8 years, but frankly, it's for much longer than that, a real systematic assault in an effort to de facto repeal the Voting Rights Act. But the broader point that I think that the voting rights stuff is just a subset of was not who got elected, but how he got elected in all kinds of communities, but in particularly in Black communities. The outpouring of citizenship in 2008, I think, is the most significant thing that has happened politically in my lifetime. And I'm 35 years old. It's so much beyond the act of voting. It's people who found ways to get involved in the political process who had never before in their lives been involved, who faced systematic efforts to drum them out of the political process for generations long. And despite that fact, found ways to get involved, for that's the revolution that occurred, not the election of a Black president. If we can figure out how to keep that level of political engagement, then we can have a very different kind of world.
Right. Okay. We did have the election of Barack Obama on Election Day, but then on the other side of that, there were anti-gay and lesbian rights propositions on the ballot this election, Florida, Arizona. But folks were watching California pretty closely because of the Supreme Court decision this summer. There was a lot of media discussion about why California's Prop 8 passed and this loss of I think there were about 18,000 or so same-sex couples who had married in California before the election. There was this breakdown discussion about who voted which way and the issue of African Americans' attitudes on gay and lesbian rights.
Its meaning, I think, it has at least three that I would suss out. One is, I want to be very clear and unequivocal about that 7 out of 10 African Americans voting to take away rights from another group of people is reprehensible. And speaks volumes about what we have to do in our community to build the kind of inclusive community that we profess to be. If I profess to love Black people and I profess to be part of a Black community, how can I be taking rights away from, you point to those 18,000 families. California has, according to U.S. Census, one of the largest populations of same-sex African-American couples in the country.
Yes.
And they, by large margins, are more likely to have children in their families than their white gay counterparts. And so what kind of community are we that we're taking rights away from them? It also speaks volumes about the gay rights movement. It is a white-led, white-dominated, middle-class movement, and Black gay activists and some well-meaning white gay activists have been trying for years to convince white gay people that their oppression is tied to their racism. And we saw it in Prop 8. Despite screaming from the rafters warnings, you have to make a significant effort in the African American community and in all the communities of color, because 5 out of 10 Latinos voted for it as well.
Yes.
They did not do it. The Yes on 8 campaign invested significantly in reaching out to communities of color. So no wonder the gay movement got its clock clean, because they ignored people of color, then they appropriated civil rights language, which is rightly offensive to a lot of straight African Americans, and then turn around and blame them for their loss. So it's worth pointing out, we have seen since the initiative failed some real disgusting racism in the gay community in response to it. And it is equally reprehensible as black homophobia. The gay community has to ask questions about what kind of community is it. Thirdly and finally, is black gay people have to ask what kind of community we want. Not enough of us show up as out and present and demanding of our rights within the African American community, and saying, "Hey, y'all, we're here," and it is unacceptable for you to tell us that we're not black. It is unacceptable for you to tell us that our families aren't the same as yours, and we're going to have to deal with it.
To that end, you have a new book out this year. Tell us a bit about Drifting Toward Love, and what led you to the work that you've done in this book, and just a bit more about its background.
Well, I mean, the book is sort of in the larger context, exactly this conversation is, you know, having covered sexual politics and race and its place in it over the last, decade plus, it's, two themes are very clear. One, gay folks have opened up a whole lot of space for themselves in America from the level of our daily lives on up to the law compared to the past. The twin reality is that space is nonetheless quite narrow and quite difficult to access for a whole lot of gay people. And so the book is about a group of people who it is particularly difficult to access for black and Latino queer youth. So I profile three young men in Brooklyn. The youngest is 14 at the beginning of the book, and the oldest is in his early 20s. And just their effort to find space and the consequences for both them and for the communities they're part of them not being able to get it.
And that book, again, is Drifting Toward Love, Black, Brown, Gay, and Coming of Age on the Streets of New York. Kai Wright, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
You as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Brooklyn-based writer and editor Kai Wright is a regular contributor to TheRoot.com.
This is my second time voting. Well, because we make a difference, and you can't just have anybody in office.
I've been voting since I was 18. Actually, I didn't vote today. I did early voting back at home in Georgia. And the reason why I voted is because, for one, we need a change as far as a black president in office, because obviously what we've been having hasn't really made a difference. Also, based on what was said in comparison between the two candidates, McCain, as far as funding for schools, he's trying to cut a lot of funding, and I feel like as being a student, I need the money to go to school and everything. I definitely think it's important for young black men, especially, and black women, to go out here and vote. I think a lot of people don't really take it serious like they should, but they really should take it serious.
Alicia Childs, 22, and Will Banks, 24, are seniors at North Carolina Central University. I spoke with them on election night, 2008. So we keep waiting on the world to change. Now if we had the power to bring our neighbors home from war, they would have never missed a Christmas. No more ribbons on their door. And when you trust your television, what you get. Caroline Streeter is a professor of English and African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Her perspectives on societal perceptions of biracialism and mixed race identity in the U.S. have been published in numerous journals and anthologies. Her forthcoming book is titled Tragic No More: The Transformation of the Mulatto, Mulatta in Post-Civil Rights Culture. Seriously, do I have to explain why I called Dr. Streeter? Here's part one of our conversation. Dr. Streeter, I want to welcome you to the Barack Obama Block Party.
Thank you. I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Wouldn't have been the same without you. Now, you're in Los Angeles right now. You're based there, professor at UCLA. What is the energy there in your community, even with your students? What has the reaction been like? What's going on there in the Los Angeles area?
Well, I watched the returns with a group of friends and colleagues in Los Angeles. We were a multiracial group, a multi-ethnic group, and everyone was extremely excited watching the returns, all of us making and receiving calls to friends and relatives from all over the world. I live in a part of Los Angeles that's very close to a traditionally working class African-American community, the Crenshaw District, and young people there became very politicized and I think have a more significant role model than they've ever had in their lives. I've heard people come to the realization that we are going to have children who have never known a time when there couldn't be a black president in office. There was a little baby at our party who's about 8 months old. And to think that for her, a black president and an African-American first family will be normal is so heart-lifting. I think that we are all extremely optimistic, and my students are very positive and very enlivened.
That's great. And I wanted to take you back there a couple of steps because you mentioned this notion of having watched this event with a multi-ethnic, multi-racial group. And what's interesting about that is so much increasingly what America looks like. And those barriers and those lines are, if not disintegrating, they certainly are shifting. And I think that you are one of the great minds working on the issue of biracial and multi-ethnic and multi-racial identity within different scopes and certainly within the gaze of the media, everybody from, you know, child prodigy and public personality Philippa Schuyler to, current R&B and pop icon Alicia Keys. What is your take on how Barack Obama's multicultural and biracial identity impacted this election?
Well, I've known about Barack Obama since 1995 when his memoir, Dreams from My Father, was published because, as you said, I've been working on biracial identity and also mixed race in popular culture for several years now. And I was struck by his 2004 address at the Democratic National Convention when he burst onto the American scene, into the American spotlight. At that time, his narrative of American identity was fascinating because it was very parallel to the white American narrative of being an immigrant, and that is to say a legal immigrant from beyond these shores, in this case Africa. He called himself a skinny kid with a funny name. And that is something that white Americans, that's very much their experience of ethnicity, what we in ethnic studies call it, marked by a difference that is obvious in terms of the name, which is so different, but not really part of the person's cultural identity. So in Barack Obama's case, being born an American citizen in Hawaii and being raised by his white American mother, his white American grandparents, he is from a multiracial part of the country. Hawaii and California both have a different ethnic makeup from the rest of the continental United States, and Hawaii in particular has a strongly Asian population, and they don't have the black-white racial divide that so dominates the mainland. And he writes about that in his memoir, but he was also a minority black person. And as he himself says, he experienced being one of the only black people in his community and also experienced being regarded as exceptional because he's biracial, which he experienced as a kind of vague discomfort until he realized that that's really a mark of racism. So, in fact, in his biography, he says several years ago, he stopped telling white people about his mother's race because he feared that that ingratiated him to white people. So he has, I think, a political perspective about biracial identity that he didn't really bring into the campaign. Starting with 2004, he really situated himself in a typically mixed-race role, which is as a bridge builder, as a conciliator, but at the same time as an exemplary African-American. And what strikes me about his position as being biracial is that, like many African-Americans who are half black, half white, he really acknowledges biracial heritage without that being exclusive with his black identity. And you and I have discussed the one-drop rule, which is the slavery-era convention that any amount of black heritage makes a person black. And at one time, that was a way to include any mixed-race people, no matter how white they might look, to include them with the African-American community to make everybody Negro and thus subject to Jim Crow, segregation, and unequal treatment. But the black community, because for civil rights, we organized across differences, across color differences, across class differences, yes, in order to achieve liberation, the black community appropriated the one-drop rule as the sign of black identity and the source of ethnic pride. And Barack Obama is part of that. Although in his case, having an African parent and not a black American parent does make him a different kind of black American.
I hear this kind of ambiguity, or at least this type of ambivalence or duality in the way that Barack Obama, the candidate, has dealt with and approached his racial identity. I'm wondering if there are some sort of ways in which the campaign actively utilized his biracial identity. Are there ways in which that played differently with one portion of the electorate versus another portion?
Well, several things. On the one hand, Barack Obama used African ethnicity to situate himself as an immigrant. And interestingly, that aligned him with the white American narrative of immigration. It also aligned him with the African American origin of identity, which is Africa. And we have a history of Afrocentrism in this country and identification with Africa. However, we're in a different time where Afrocentrism is no longer, I think, something that a lot of people identify with, and it is even seen as somewhat radical, which was the case in the demonization of Jeremiah Wright. The idea that there is black racism, or that blacks hate whites, that whole idea of reverse racism is really related to black power and Afrocentrism and the fear of that. And in Barack Obama's case, the fact that he repudiated Reverend Wright and then gave the race speech, which again was about historically making Afrocentrism understandable for the majority of Americans and saying this black-white racial divide and this original sin of slavery is the traumatic wounding in the country that needs to be resolved. But by the same token, now we have a multi-ethnic America where the differences between us are not as important as our similarities in terms of we live in American democracy, we share ideals, we all want the same things. So he does a very interesting thing where he weaves together different people's experiences. He shows us our commonalities, but he does come from a kind of post-civil rights political, a younger generation that doesn't want to be as radical as some of the civil rights elements, but still take they still take their desires to change the society and to bring equality to everyone, that's based in civil rights politics.
That was part one of my conversation with Caroline Streeter, professor of English and African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Check out the second half on part two of the show, The After Part.
I'm still delivered. I'm yours. I'm yours. Ooh, we think you're setting my soul on fire. That's why I know you're my only desire. Ooh, baby, here I am. I'm still delivered. I'm yours.
My name is Tyson Marsh, and I'm dropping an audio postcard to the Barack Obama block party from Alexandria, Egypt, where I work as principal at the International American School of Alexandria and living in self-selected political exile for the past 4 years. At 5:30 a.m. in Alexandria, my English teacher woke me up with a tap on the shoulder to inform me that Barack Obama would be the next president. What a beautiful awakening for myself, the United States, and the whole world. I spent 6 days trying to understand the thoughts that wrenched my mind and my heart as I wiped the sleep from my eyes. The first 60 seconds, I was awake. And I can now say that all those emotions, thoughts, tears, and happiness were in reality the awakening and consciousness of a newborn patriot. With love and hope, not just for country, but for the possibility of being part of something that has the potential to give to and heal humanity as opposed to oppressing it. In 4 years, little positive could be said about the U.S. from an Egyptian, Arab, or Muslim perspective, but there is something to be said as many Egyptians have expressed their admiration and respect for our president-elect. And I say our because that is how many Egyptians have been referring to Barack Obama. Our kids were all happy. Although they're young, they recognize that there's something a bit more like them than George Bush. While there is always skepticism, I have never felt the universe project so much hope. Regardless of race, faith, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, nationality, class, age, hope is a good place to start. Love, peace, and respect to Barack Obama and his beautiful family, the 44th President of the United States of America, but our first.
This is our chance to answer that call. This is our moment. This is our time to put our people back to work and open doors of opportunity for our kids, to restore prosperity and promote the cause of peace, to reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope, and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
It's a mountaintop moment for America. When our 44th president was born in August 1961, his story was impossible. Black folks couldn't freely access public facilities or enter a polling place in many parts of the country, much less run for president. His parents' interracial marriage was illegal in more than a dozen states. Even as the civil rights movement peaked in the 1960s of Obama's childhood 4 decades ago, few people dreamed America would see a black president so soon. The same was true 4 years ago, perhaps even 4 months ago. Yet that moment has arrived. So we celebrate. We prepare, and as we do, we pay homage to our forebears and reflect on the meaning of family. We honor our mothers who, as women, didn't gain the right to vote in 1870 when the 15th Amendment gave black men the ballot, and who remained barred when white women were enfranchised by the 19th Amendment in 1920, nearly 3 decades after even the black male vote had been wrenched away by Jim Crow, shotguns, and lynch ropes. After decades of struggle and activism, the 1965 Voting Rights Act restored the vote to black men, but granted full citizenship to black women for the first time in U.S. history. 43 years and 10 presidential elections later, a black man has been elected president of all America's people. We honor Democrat Shirley Chisholm, the first black congresswoman who, in 1972, became the first African-American to campaign for a major party's nomination. Chisholm battled racism and sexism, blasting through glass ceilings and that ones, and paving the way for both Hillary Clinton and President-elect Barack Obama. Chisholm received only perfunctory memorial mention at the recent Democratic National Convention, but both candidates stood on her shoulders in this marathon election cycle. We honor the American family. The president-elect's campaign invoked the notion of a collective American family, and as family, we revel in his victory. But then we do what any good family does, demand the very best. Especially as people of color, we need to lovingly, sternly, hold our newest president's feet to the fire. No first black president pass on a truly diverse cabinet, sorely needed civil rights legislation, or fair government administration. No people of color hookup on our expectations of transparency and openness to the people and the press. And as kinfolk, we too must pitch in and sacrifice to be the change we need to see in our nation. Finally, just like family, we need to hold our favorite son to his name, reminding him of who he is. Barack, from the Ki Swahili, blessed to be a blessing. Barack, from the Hebrew, bright shining, prayerful. Hussein, from the Arabic, beautiful and good, and nothing less. For the Tara Lake Podcast, I'm Tara Lake.
Message wherever you stand, I'm calling every woman, calling every man. We're the generation that can't afford to wait. The future started yesterday, and we're already late.
And that's going to do it for the Barack Obama Block Party and for the debut installment of the Tara Lake Podcast. Join me for part two of this podcast, The After Party, which features a roundtable wrap-up and the second half of my interview with Dr. Caroline Streeter. For more information on any of today's guests, visit taralake.com. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Hit me up at taralakeshow@gmail.com. Let's pause now to remember the life of singer and activist Miriam Zinzi Makeba, Mama Africa. Makeba's passionate commitment to freedom in South Africa and the continent at large, her love for African people and the good of all humanity were matched only by the dynamism of her passionate performances. She was, and always will be, a towering voice, just and beautiful. Miriam Makeba collapsed on stage in Naples, Italy, on November 10, 2008. She was 76 years old. I leave you with a bit of her signature classic, Pata Pata. Until next time, I'm Tara Lake.